Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Well, Jim and Austin, there's been a lot happening south of the border. We've been distracted from it a little bit with our focus over in the Middle East and like that. But Austin, you wrote an article this week on the Mexico cartels and the wars with the cartels. And part of the problem that Jim has mentioned in one of his articles is the amount of violence that's happening across the border. What can you tell us about that?
Well, one of the things is that I wrote my Creator Syndicate column this week about Mexico's cartel war, as we call it, on Strategy Page and in the new edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. I think that's as good a name for it as anything. But it is yet another Mexican civil war, but one with deep roots and narcotic smuggling, because that's one of the that's a major source of financing for the biggest threat to Mexico, which is these cartel gangs and their ability to corrupt police officials, corrupt the political system, and buy weapons. Now, when I say the biggest threat to Mexico, understand that the U.S. Justice Department, and this was the Justice Department, issued a National Drug Threat Assessment. I think that's what they call them. There's one that was a couple years ago, but then they've got to updated it and updated it recently when it says that basically Mexican narco-traficante organizations are the greatest organized crime threat to the United States. And you could say, hey, well, I guess that makes sense given that they have their own small armies, and they do, that they operate really throughout the United States in relationship to other organized criminal gangs. I read recently, and I actually put this in a Strategy Page Mexico update, that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms says that it is investigating three cells, C-E-L-L-S, of the Gulf Cartel, which is one of the major Mexican drug cartels, that operate in Houston. And one of their chief jobs, at least from the angle of the Gulf Cartel, is acquiring weapons. Now, some of that can be taken with several grains of salt, because these guys can acquire weapons in lots and lots of places, but it's very easy to acquire them in the United States, and they smuggle them back across the border, which is why the Mexican government's big counter-complaint when the United States complains about drug traffickers bringing dope north is they say you have an iron river of guns that comes from north to south. Just remember, though, that the drug cartels can buy weapons in lots and lots of places, but it's easy to do it in the United States. Anyway, that's just that Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms report went through a lot of U.S. media outlets as well, and I think there was some very, very good reporting as a result of it, but began to look the mainstream media really in the last month at the penetration of these Mexican drug cartels into the United States. So it's not just a Mexican war, which it is. It is an international drug war with real significance for the United States. Now let's go to something that Jim had added to that Mexico update I did for Strategy Page. And that is, as Jim pointed out, that on an quote-unquote average day in Iraq, 26 people, isn't that the right figure, Jim? 26?
Yeah,
26 people are killed in terror and criminal-related violence in Iraq. And understand that, as we've talked about this before here on Strategy Talk, I wrote a column about it that's up on the On Point section that I want to say was late August, early September, about how miscible, how connected criminal activity and terror activity are in so many places on the planet. General Petraeus, in that interview I did with General Petraeus in August, commented on that, and I used that comment to write another column examining it. Now, it's something that we cover on Strategy Page all the time. Look at Jim's analysis of Colombia as an example of it, where politics and drugs, well, heck, the criminals ate out the lefty radicals, and now the FARC is little more than a very sophisticated information operation covering a drug cartel. The Mexican cartels, if I may say so, I think they're smarter than FARC, because they don't even want to mess with having a political veneer. They're not stuck with that. All they want to do is buy politicians, move guns, and control areas of Mexico, control it from inside with their money and with their guns and by intimidation if they need to do so. Okay, so the way that they're doing it, it comes up that 26 people are killed in these kind of incidents in Iraq. Well, about 700 people, and a figure one that I saw published in one of the Mexican newspapers was 701 people were killed in Mexico in the month of November over a 30-day period. Now, as a point out, it's a little bit apples and oranges to compare Iraq and Mexico. Strategically, they're very different. They've got a different historical pressures, different cultural contexts, and Iraq's always got to deal with Iranian finagling, among other, and plus Syrians as well, a different strategic context. But at the street level, if you're a victim of gangland violence, and Al-Qaeda is really more than a murder gang, it's a little more than that, there are some similarities. Mexico has about 3.5 times the population of Iraq, so if 23 people or 24 people are killed a day in Mexico, you can say, well, it's more violent in Iraq because the Iraqis have fewer people. Roughly 28 million, I think, is the figure. Mexico is somewhere around 100 million. So there's your there's a differential there. But this is one of the things that Jim noted. He says that most of this violence is in northern Mexico or in Mexico City. In northern
right.
Mexico, we're talking about Baja California Norte, where Tijuana is, Sinaloa State, Chihuahua State, where Juarez is, Ciudad Juarez, which is a huge city. I mean, it is much larger than El Paso. It's El Paso's Mexican twin. And Ciudad Juarez has been off limits to Fort Bliss soldiers now for almost a year. June of 2008 is when the commander of Fort Bliss put it thoroughly off limits. But if you go back, you can see warnings about U.S. soldiers and travelers that go back to, I want to say February of 2008, but June 2008 is when it goes absolutely off limits, and you can get on the web at the Bliss site and read the command order about it. It's very enlightening command order.
Now, Austin, it isn't one of the reasons, one of the parts that goes unreported about the violence is the kidnappings.
Well, let me talk right down the border.
Okay.
This long-winded, so be it. This is Strategy Page, and we can do that. You go on down Nuevo Laredo and even Matamoros on the Texas border. Huge amounts of violence. Nuevo Laredo has been where the paramilitary or wing of the Gulf cartel, which now operates in many ways its own cartel, the Zetas, who were founded by Mexican military deserters. That's where they've carved out their operation. Now, you brought up kidnapping. Kidnapping is a component of it. It's a component of terror crime in Iraq. It's a component of terror crime in Mexico. And the gangs run it, and they use it both to make money, just like terrorist criminal organizations inside Iraq do it, and to intimidate, just like terrorists and criminal organizations in Iraq do it. So go back to Jim's bigger point on this is that, hey, take this very, very seriously, because you can see the significant swath of this war is being fought not only near the American border, it's being fought in a population zone roughly comparable. It's more actually in absolute numbers than Iraq, but the number of people killed is significantly similar to what the American people know about in Iraq because of the way the press covers it. Up until the last 4 to 6 weeks, Mexico has largely gone uncovered by what I'll call mainstream media. I've noticed a shift since late November. It could deal with the fact that over 700 people were killed in Mexico in late November. We've, of course, been reporting on Strategy Page. We've got years and years of following up on a situation in Mexico, but starting in December of 2006, when President Calderon launched this war, we've covered it very, very closely and noticed the analogs to other counterinsurgencies going on around the planet. Now, I'll wind this up with one other point. I made the point about danger to the United States, the situation in Mexico. Let me expand on one point on that: corruption. Felipe Calderon understands that corruption is the biggest threat to Mexico. That's the reason he's taken a systemic approach to what he calls restructuring, transformational restructuring in Mexico, because he can't just kill the drug lords and arrest them. He's got to change the judiciary, change the police, and build what he calls, you know, a modern country that's run on the rule of laws. The final line in my column from this week, which I hope everybody will check out in on point, is I see Calderon emerging really as a major global political talent. This guy is doing all the right things in a very, very difficult situation. And if you don't think he isn't drug gang target number one, he is.
Right. Now, Jim, one of the interesting things is, you know, we've had these chats and we write the articles on a Strategy Page, is a component almost of every one of these countries that is having problems is corruption. And we've seen that for a long time down in Colombia, right?
Yeah, well, corruption is something that exists worldwide. There's an organization called Transparency International, which it's a volunteer organization, and I think it's about 10 or so years ago, they started doing a comparative in corruption index for countries everywhere. And it shows you pretty much that, you know, the more prosperous countries are less corrupt, and the countries with more problems, be they economic or criminal, military, tend to be more corrupt. But there are other factors, especially in the Western Hemisphere. And one that most people tend to be unaware of or ignore is the fact that it's not just the United States which has lots of guns in the hands of the people. That is much is made of that, especially in Europe, but it's all of the Western Hemisphere is more, you know, strapped, have more guns, and there's more gun violence. Canada is an exception. Indeed, the further north you go, you know, the less, you know, gun activity you have. You can make of that what you will.
Except for Detroit, right?
But in northern South America, there's, for hundreds of years, there's been a tradition of packing a gun. And in Colombia in particular, that's ground zero for the gun culture. They've had this, you know, left-right civil war going on for over half a century. It really got rolling after World War II. They call it La Violencia, the violence. And FARC and ELN and other leftist organizations came out of it. Then what is described as a right-wing militia, the AUC, it's really a, you know, it was really a reaction. They're not really, the AUC is not all that political. But they were just a defensive reaction by many Colombians to the banditry, the kidnappings, the murders of people, because the left-wing guerrilla organizations basically sustained themselves by plundering people who had money. And the people who had money eventually got tired of it and said, you know, all right, we're going to form our own organization. And it got really nasty because they basically played the same way, using terror and just gunning down people they suspected or whatever of being after, you know, being the leftist guerrillas. And it's only in the last 6 years when a new president was elected and basically said, look, you know, we have to cut all this crap out. We have to be less corrupt. That's something you don't hear. The guy's name is Uribe. He basically talked about clean government and effective government. You know, commentators outside of Colombia, you know, tend to pigeonhole him as a rightist. you know, anybody who's in favor of clean government and less corruption is automatically Republican. You can make it out of what you will. But the fact of the matter is he attracted the majority of Colombians, you know, to his idea. You know, sort of like Obama before Obama. But the leftists, you know, in the United States will never admit that. He basically said, yes, we can. And he proceeded to do it. But you still have this gun culture in Colombia. The crime rate and the death rate has come way down, but it's still several times higher than the United States. And it probably always will be, because many countries in South America have enormous frontier areas. I mean, think the American West 100 or so years ago, where you still had banditos running around. I mean, like where you are out in Utah. You had bad lands and you had bad people out there, you know, decades ago, half a century ago. And it takes a long time to eliminate all or most of this. And South America is still 100 years behind the United States. I mean, they have areas where people have their private armies. I mean, it's all the old, you know, Western themes. You know, the herders versus the farmers, the sidebusters, and vigilante justice and what have you. It still exists down there. Except they have automatic weapons now. And normally the United States would stay away from it, because it is a messy business, except in Colombia you had the drugs. Same thing with Afghanistan and Somalia. These are, as Austin has described several times in his columns, failed states. And failed states people like to stay away from, because they're like the old tar baby. The more they hit it, the more you're stuck. But when large drug businesses get set up, or any large criminal enterprise gets set up in these areas, whether it be terrorism, or like in Chechnya, it was kidnapping. That's what brought the Russians back in 99. They were content to leave the Chechens to their own devices, but basically several large gangs decided, hey, this is a great hideout for a very lucrative kidnapping business, and at one point they had 3,000 people kidnapped throughout southern Russia and spirited away to their safe base in Chechnya. And that's what brought on, you know, the big war in Chechnya. That doesn't get reported much in the West. I can't figure out why, but it's the big headline over in Russia. That's why they bothered going back into Chechnya. Well, drugs are the main reason we're going into Colombia, and the main and a secondary reason to the fact that the Mexican gangs are committing murders on our side of the border increasingly. But it's the drugs in Somalia and Afghanistan. You know, it's the terrorism. But these things go on whether we get involved or not, and they will continue to go on. There are not just failed states; there are semi-failed states like Pakistan. And several others we won't go into. But in Colombia, you basically have a positive situation. You could be optimistic about Colombia because they have, unlike many of these other, you know, failing states, they have fixed or are in the process of fixing their own problem, and they have made tremendous strides. Now, what you're getting on around Colombia is like Venezuela and Ecuador, countries which are sliding in the other direction. Both have leftist governments. I don't know if I'm not saying leftist governments have anything to do with failed states, but they do have a lot to do with economic dysfunction. In other words, ruining the economy, which creates more unemployment, more poverty, and more violence. You know, people have to eat and they'll use weapons, which they have plenty of in both those countries, in order to get their way. It also breeds resistance organizations. And, you know, the kind of La Violencia that got started in Colombia. So what's happening in Colombia, good news, it's getting better. Bad news is little Colombias are popping up, you know, throughout South America.
Right. Now, Venezuela is becoming, well, has probably always been a thorn in Colombia's side in the fact that they're now letting groups form over the border, or they always have been, but it's even become worse recently, correct?
Well, yeah, that's politics. Hugo Chavez, a Venezuelan populist politician who is basically preaching a leftist, a socialist revolution, which will solve all the social problems, and they have plenty of social problems down there. He's more talk than action. He's another example of the oil curse. this has been pointed out in the last decade, that if you look at all the non-industrialized nations that have large, significant oil reserves, the oil money does not help the majority of the people. In other words, the corrupt leadership of the country gets their hands on that money and basically only spreads it as far as they have to in order to keep themselves in power, which means, you know, a few percent of the population gets 90% of the oil money. This makes the other 90% very unhappy, but if the people who have the oil money are smart, they set up an effective police state, and police states can be very effective, as we're seeing in places like Cuba and North Korea, and keep themselves in power. And that is a problem that you didn't see develop in Venezuela. There they did try and spread the oil money around. They did create a middle class, which is unusual in developed, as it were, oil rich countries. But they still left the majority of the population poor.
Right.
So being half successful doesn't count. You know, it's like being slightly pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. Chavez came along and said, look, we're going to spread this money to everybody. And he's basically making himself increasingly unpopular because while he talks a good line, he doesn't produce. He's basically spending the money to, get this, keep himself in power. Sound familiar? So basically Venezuela has gone from, you know, not so bad to worse. They had a democracy which went through the motions and did more than most other countries, spread the oil money around. They were reaching maybe 20-30% of the population, which is 10 times more than most of these other, oligarchies, based on oil wealth. Chavez says, hey, I'm going to do it all. I'm going to ruin the country in the process. And since he's a leftist, he basically got caught when they captured those laptop computers in that raid on the Ecuador border.
Right.
And that basically made it fairly blatant. He backpedaled off of that real quick. And that's been extremely embarrassing to leftists all over the world, especially in the, in Europe. And in other Latin American countries, because it provided proof for what people long suspected, that a lot of these leftists were very very energetically assisting these organizations like FARC, which have been declared by most countries to be international terrorist organizations. Chavez has been letting FARC, which has been losing their war for the last 6 years, big time. They've lost half their gunmen in the last 6 years, to set up safe haven, safe bases, refugees on the Venezuelan side of the border. The problem is these guys don't know how to behave, the FARC people, and they basically have begun extorting and pillaging the Venezuelans where they're staying. Now, you shouldn't do that. If you got half a brain and you got a safe haven, you basically don't do where you eat, as the old saying goes. But a lot of these guys did not get the memo.
Right. They forgot to read Mao's little book on that.
Exactly.
Right?
You know, if you're going to swim in the water, don't, do nasty stuff in the water. Chavez is basically caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, we haven't gotten any new memos from email from Chavez, but I'm sure, he's been putting the message out, for God's sake, stop it, because now Chavez has an uprising against him and FARC on his own border area. Now, the people out on the border, and we're talking a frontier, again, this is a sparsely populated area. And a lot of the people out there are, like most frontiersmen, very independent-minded. They never cared much. They figured, hey, we're not getting any oil from those yo-yos, in Caracas, in the capital. Hey, as long as they leave us alone, we're not going to, get too upset about that. But now, Chavez has basically invited all these gangsters from Colombia to come visit their neighborhood and bring their crime wave with them. They are not happy. So you're basically going to see our media, which tends to be somewhat left-leaning, they're going to start describing any Venezuelans who fight FARC as, left, right-wing militias, vigilantes, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, what can they do? They're getting no help not much help. Chavez has sent some military units, more military units to the border, but it's a huge border. We're talking over 1,000 kilometers. And it's rugged, you know, sparsely, you know, it's forested, you know, hills,
yeah.
Jungles. And it's very difficult, you know, to cover the whole area. And he's basically just going through the motions, and most Venezuelans out there know it. So if you're going to see a rebel groups arise in Venezuela, that's one of the places, you know, where they're going to come up. In the meantime, Chavez has basically offended, and this is pretty astounding for a leftist politician, he's offended the university community. So he's got the students and the faculty against him. Boy, that's an achievement you don't want to talk about, but it's an achievement nonetheless. So he's basically got the cowboys out on the frontier and the university students up against him. So it's going to be a revolution, but if nothing else, it'll be an interesting revolution.
Now, Brazil is one of the bright spots down south, correct?
Yes. Now, there's a case where you have leftists with brains. That probably didn't come out right. Well, anyway, the guy, the current president, who's got a labor union background, and the people he brought in with him, he says, I may be a leftist, you know, labor leader, but I understand the necessity of creating jobs, and government doesn't create jobs. And he basically unleashed the entrepreneurs. He has some corruption scandals, but not as somewhat below average for Brazil. So, you know, relatively speaking, he's cleaner than the people before him. And he's basically made some pretty shrewd, you know, economic moves. He still likes to spread the wealth around, but he realizes you got to make the wealth first. Brazil hasn't have a lot of oil. I mean, there's basically a country that its wealth is built upon entrepreneurship, going out there and making something of, you know, what natural resources there are. And he's been very good at that. So, you know, Brazil is a bright spot. Most of the South American countries that have done well economically have basically looked at North America and said, well, how do they do it in the United States? What's so special about, you know, the Blancos up there? And they have, there's been a number of Latin American academics who have gone up and taken, many of them went to, you know, got their graduate degrees in North America, Canada, the United States. And they looked at it and said, oh, yeah, it's very simple. You basically got to make the place entrepreneur-friendly. If people can start businesses, they will create jobs,
right.
First for their families, then for their neighbors. And if some guys, and you've got billionaires in Mexico and Latin America who basically practice, you know, what these academics are preaching, you create millions of jobs. And so that's become accepted by a lot of politicians, not Hugo Chavez. But a lot of politicians in Latin America. But implementing it is difficult because you basically have centuries of what is called status. In other words, state control of more than is acceptable in the United States. This was something Britain went through after World War II, and Margaret Thatcher basically eliminated. He says, look, you know, we're not good. Even communist China did it. They put 30 million people out of work in the 90s. By basically shutting down these state-run companies that were losing money. There's no other way to put it. And the Chinese economy, as a consequence, came roaring back. The Indians did it. Once they saw the success the Chinese were having.
Right.
But, you know, again, a lot of politicians never get the message. And that's where you tend to have problems.
Austin? What's happening in the rest of, we'll wrap it up with this. What's happening in the rest of Central America?
One of the big things that I have followed, and I follow it because you can actually, you see this cropping up in the Mexican media. I've even seen it in a couple of the wire services, and that is the concern among other Central American countries. Guatemala is an example. And Guatemala may be the premier example now that I think about it. Fear that Mexico's narcotics war is going to spill over onto them. Now, that's already happened in Guatemala to some degree. I don't know if you recall, maybe it's a month ago. I'm not sure that we covered this on Strategy Page. I don't think we did, but... there was a shootout in northern Guatemala that was, according to Guatemalan authorities, related to operations by a Mexican drug gang. And look at the place that it occurred. It's very close to the Mexican border. The Mexicans, just as an aside on this, are very, very careful about their Guatemalan and Belizean borders because they don't want illegal immigrants coming into Mexico. That's a something that doesn't get reported a great deal here in the United States, but they do watch it. Nevertheless, of course, it's a jungle border. The Guatemala's Petén region is essentially all Maya land is really what it amounts to, Maya Indian land. But that's one of the concerns. Guatemala is still wrestling with the effects of its three decades long government versus the communist war. That really had a lot of aspects. I remember covering this in the first edition of Quick and Dirty Guide to War back in the mid-1980s, is a lot of that was still an Indian war. The Indians were caught in a crossfire between the government, the Spaniards, and the government. They might not call them that, but that's essentially...
Yeah, sounds of the colonialists.
They do get called that, don't they? And
yeah.
The Spaniards among the leftists, you know, the communists operating as with the contacts and...
It was the right-wing upper class versus the left-wing upper class.
That's right. And a lot of aspects of that were played out in Guatemala as a really just a... That's another war on the Mayans. Certainly the Mayans saw it in that perspective. The point is that here's Guatemala with all the economic pressures it faces, being largely resource... comparatively resource poor, all of the internal social and ethnic divisions there in Guatemala, and yet they're trying to eke along, get past the long effect of that long war, and here are the drug cartels with Guatemala not as a destination, but as a waypoint. And with money, and they see the drug cartels as, of course, while they're selling drugs in the United States, it's a U.S. social problem, and the Mexican gangs are the ones who are servicing it in connection with South American gangs, and we're squeezed again. Another interesting case, though, in Central America, you ask is Nicaragua, and Nicaragua, to some degree, as Jim was mentioning there, you know, it's a battle between the elites. We're seeing the old leftist elites, or the old, I'm not going to call them right-wing elites, just economic elites in this case, because their politics, a lot of these guys' politics shift. You know, I'm not sure that the Ortega brothers are really leftists anymore, more than just elitists. They're the Ortegas who were the Sandinistas. But there's a large political scrap going on between the elites in Nicaragua with resonance from the old Nicaraguan civil war from the toppling of Somoza in the late 70s and then the Sandinista regime in the 80s to the early 90s. But it's kind of going on well below the radar. But once again, they're in a transit point. They're the transit point for the drug flow coming out of South America and heading towards Mexico. So some of the other things we might talk about in the future, though, Dan, is looking at the Caribbean politics, Venezuela's influence in the Caribbean, Venezuela's contacts with Nicaragua, by the way. There's still some of those. It's Chavez playing his, as Jim said, his whatever kind of leftist credentials he's got. Remember, he was an army officer at one time, and I believe he was regarded at one time as a right winger. And he's now, at least rhetorically, wants to be a new Castro. But looking at Venezuela's land claims in the Caribbean, their claims against Colombia, even past Panama and towards Nicaragua, and allegations of Venezuelan financial interest, influence, or connections to some of the Mexican drug gangs. You see that come out of Mexico every once in a while. Don't hear the government make a lot of noise about it, but those allegations are there, and just looking at the kind of character Chavez is, and as Jim pointed out, when Colombia launched a raid into Ecuador, they got a hold of the FARC computer and totally nailed him for dealing with FARC. So even though you don't see evidence and you don't hear the authorities specifically talking about it based on his track record, it's the kind of thing that Chavez and his intelligence agencies would, it's the kind of thing it looks like they might touch because they just kind of see where it would go. So anyway, that's something we can save for the future.